Alistair asked if I would give some kind of theological rationale or justification for staying in the Church of Scotland. In August 2011, at a gathering in Inverness, I gave a paper outlining three reasons why I was convinced we should remain in the Church of Scotland. And that paper took me 45 minutes to deliver. Tonight I want to give you seven reasons for staying in the Church of Scotland, but Alistair has given me 20 minutes, and Colin says if I take 21, he'll close with the benediction. But on a serious note, you will understand that I'm giving summaries of these 7 points, and much more detail lies behind them. I think they're going to go there up on the screen. That's good. The first reason for remaining is that nothing has changed. The current situation of the Church of Scotland, despite the reports in the newspapers, is that nothing has actually changed. The motion, which is adopted by the General Assembly following the report of the Theological Commission, had two parts. On the one hand, it reaffirmed the traditionalist position to be the position of the Church of Scotland. On the other hand, it gave congregations the right to opt out of the Church's position and to agree to call a minister in a same-sex civil partnership. In order for this to become the law of the Church, however, a piece of legislation called an overture, for those who are not familiar with the terminology, an overture is needed. That will be prepared and presented to next year's General Assembly by the Legal Questions Committee. If approved by the General Assembly of 2014, it will go down to presbyteries for their approval. If it's approved by the presbyteries, it will come back for final approval by the General Assembly of 2015. At the same time, the new Theological Forum of the Church of Scotland has been asked to consider the ecclesiological issues which this proposal raises. In other words, how will this all work out in practice? And it will report to the General Assembly of 2014. The overture could, of course, fail at any one of 3 points: at the General Assembly of 2014, at the presbytery stage, or at the General Assembly of 2015. In the meantime, no one living in a same-sex sexual relationship can be ordained or inducted. And so even those who believe that we ought to leave the Church of Scotland if such legislation is passed, and I am not one of them, it is premature to leave at this point. Secondly, God and the nation. There is nothing in the Bible about denominations. In many ways, denominations are a curse rather than a blessing. The idea of multiple denominations as we have them today is entirely foreign to the Bible. What the Bible does talk about is nations. The Bible calls nations to submit to God. There are also promises of God's blessing on those nations which do submit to the Lord. When God called Abraham in Genesis 12, he told him he was going to be the father of a great nation. But interestingly, he also told him that other nations would be blessed by that great nation. In the Old Testament prophets, we see them speaking not only to Israel and Judah, but to the nations. In Matthew 25, in the parable of the Last Judgment, it is the nations that are gathered before God. And anyone who's read the Old Testament should not be surprised by that language. And it seems to me that we have neglected the place of God's corporate dealings with nations. In the Bible, God works through families, through tribes, through nations, through Israel, through the church. In my view, we've been so affected by Western individualism that we've completely neglected the corporate nature of God's dealings with humanity. And this affects our reading of the Bible. The church is regarded by many people not as a corporate body formed by God through His Spirit and through which God works, but as a collection of individuals who have banded together for religious purposes. This neglect of the nations in the plan and purposes of God was not something of which our Scottish forebears were guilty. Quite the reverse. They were concerned for the nation. The establishment principle established in the post-Reformation period in Scotland remains vital for our self-understanding. Knox and Melville did not regard the Church of Scotland as a denomination among others. They regarded Scotland as a covenanted nation under God, with the Kirk being the public expression of the religious life of the nation of Scotland. The relationship between church and state is based on that theological understanding. And they also recognize the importance of the church's prophetic ministry in speaking to the nation and calling the nation to order its affairs properly before God. It follows from this, in my understanding, that the Church of Scotland has a public duty to the nation and people of Scotland. We have a responsibility to provide worship, Bible teaching, and pastoral care in every corner of the land. You might say that we have a covenant with the nation and people of Scotland. We're not congregationalists. We're Presbyterians. It's also a fact that if you want to reach the whole country, you might say that the Church of Scotland's the only game in town. On the wider front, the Church of Scotland also has a public duty towards Presbyterians all over the world. The Kirk is the mother church of world Presbyterianism, and Presbyterians all over the world look to us, even when, as now, they grieve over the direction the church may be taking. They pray with us that a more biblical position can be restored. Thirdly, the Reformed doctrine of the church. John Calvin, in his commentary on Psalm 15, notes that believers sometimes feel they should leave a church in which there is moral corruption in order to form a purer church. Calvin strongly resists this idea and was very critical of the Anabaptists who were urging people to leave and to form pure churches. Now, of course, Calvin stresses that we must not be indifferent to sin and we must do everything we can to purify and reform the church. Ultimately, however, he says there is no such thing as a pure church, and reminds us of the scripture that says that there will be wheat and tares in the church until the day of judgment, and that it is Christ who has the responsibility for the final separation and not us. When we think of the condition of the church in Calvin's day, surely 1,000 times worse than the state of the Church of Scotland, it's instructive that he calls believers to remain and condemns the Anabaptists for leaving. Why? Because of his reformed understanding of the church. Today, many people do not understand this. Instead, they have become voluntarists or congregationalists or even Anabaptists. In the reformed doctrine of the church is not a voluntary society. It is a covenanted community established by God and not by us. The idea that people would pick and choose their denomination on the basis of their individual tastes is entirely foreign to the Bible and to the Reformed doctrine of the church. The geographical model established by the Church of Scotland is a biblical model, where believers in a certain location or parish gather together as a fellowship of the Lord's people. Fourthly, the sovereignty of God. Over the past 4 years, and particularly during the last 2 years when I served on the Theological Commission, I've been told by many people that we have no option but to leave the Church of Scotland, because even if we are successful in the current phase of the crisis, those who oppose our evangelical position will come back again and again until eventually they win the day. Now, I must say that I can't understand that, because it seems to me to be a denial of the sovereignty of God. How can it be that those who argue in favor of what the Bible calls sin will ultimately triumph? And many of those who've made this argument to me, you know, it's all going to get worse and worse and eventually they'll win and take over the church, they claim to be Calvinists. But at the same time, they seem to assume that God cannot vindicate his word and vindicate his people and transform the church. The children in my Sunday school sometimes sing a song, "My God is a great big God." Well, my God is a great big God, and he's able to do whatever pleases him. He's the sovereign Lord, and he can turn things around in an instant. The whole of the Soviet Empire fell in about 12 months. Church of Scotland's not such a big task. If we believe in the sovereignty of God, then we should not lose heart, because God and good will ultimately triumph and not sin and evil. Fifthly, the providence of God. It is notoriously difficult to read the providence of God except in retrospect. But I do believe that in his providence, God has been doing a remarkable work in the Church of Scotland over many years, and I see no reason why he would stop now. There was a day when there were very few evangelical ministers and congregations in the Church of Scotland. Eric Alexander once said that when he was a student, they could have met in a telephone box. When the Creagh Fellowship began, it met in the sitting room of a manse. Now, when the Creagh Fellowship meets, there are hundreds present. God has raised up several generations of ministers who trust God and believe his word and have sought to build congregations on solid foundations. And in my view, looking at the various trajectories of statistics, if the present crisis had not divided us, with some leaving the church, we would be progressing towards the point where we would have become a majority in the church and able to restore the church to its roots in Scripture. Is it any wonder that the devil should seek to prevent this happening? I still believe we can recover the Church of Scotland, but it takes that bit longer for everyone who leaves. You will understand that I was delighted when the Highland Theological College was permitted to educate candidates for the ministry of the Church of Scotland. I confess I was also astonished. Even we were not expecting that to happen. I can say that now that I've left. That was the first time in 400 years that theological education in the Church of Scotland moved outside Glasgow, Edinburgh, St Andrews and Aberdeen. Why did God do that when no one expected it? Why would God allow an opportunity for men and women to be trained for the ministry of the Church of Scotland in an evangelical college? And that's to say nothing of the work that's being blessed by God in parishes all over the country. We all know stories of great things that God is doing. The evidence to me of God's providence is that he's not finished with the Church of Scotland yet, and therefore neither should we. Number six, the sin of schism. Now, of course, I recognize that there can come a time when a church has become so corrupt and has so abandoned the faith that it might be necessary to leave. I believe, however, that that's an extreme situation, and I do not believe that we are in that situation today. For that reason, I find it very disturbing when people use the language of apostasy, say that the Church of Scotland is no longer a true church. We must be very careful in the language that we use and in our assessment of the situation in which we find ourselves. John Calvin recognized that there were many faults in the Roman Catholic Church of his day, but he still said that it had the rudiments of a true church, not least in respect of its commitment to the historic doctrines of the creeds. For that reason, it's consistently been the practice of the Reformed churches that we do not rebaptize those who come from the Roman Catholic Church. If the Roman Catholic Church in Calvin's day had about it the rudiments of a true church, then how can anyone argue that the Church of Scotland is not a true church? Nevertheless, we must agree that the Church of Scotland has certainly moved some distance from its moorings in Scripture and in the Westminster Confession of Faith. But even the Westminster Confession of Faith itself says that some churches become so degenerate that they are no longer true churches, but then adds this: the purest churches under heaven are subject both to mixture and error. Those who are calling our people to leave and join them on the grounds that they are a pure church need to go back to their Bibles. It seems to me that schism or secession or disruption is a very serious matter indeed. Is it ever justified? More particularly, when should I, as a Church of Scotland minister, consider leaving the church? Well, I think only under two conditions. One, that the church has demonstrably departed from the Christian faith. And second, when the judgment is reached, that it is not recoverable. In my own view, the Church of Scotland is recoverable, and I believe that those of us who are true to our Orthodox Reformed heritage should refuse to walk away. Why should we give our church to the liberals? It's foolishness. Instead, we should work and pray to recover it. Number 7, learning from history. Those of you who have studied church history will know that secessions, schisms, disruptions, and splits rarely achieve anything, and few last more than a generation. The residue of our divided Presbyterianism is there for all to see. I could take you to small Highland villages with 4 Presbyterian churches to serve less than 600 people. Do we really want to make it 5? Is the situation not scandalous enough to tie down 4 ministers in one place when there are other places where there is no gospel ministry? To say nothing of the resources wasted on 4 churches, 4 manses, and usually 4 halls and 4 stipends. Think of what that could do if it was liberated for mission. Think of that. And the other lesson we learn from church history is that the Church of Scotland has gone through good times and bad times, high times and low times, times of great gospel witness and missionary expansion, and dark days when there was hardly any light to be seen. In all of this, God has never left himself without a witness, and he has regularly restored his church and renewed it and revitalized it. He has even brought glorious days of revival. When we read the history of Israel, that's surely what we ought to expect. The Israelites regularly fell into sin and disobedience. They even went after other gods. When they did so, the Lord punished them. He withdrew from them. He allowed their enemies to triumph over them. And very often only a remnant survived who did not succumb to sin and disobedience, but God kept his covenant promises and restored them again. What God did for Israel, he can do for the Church of Scotland. In the meantime, we must serve as that faithful remnant. After all, in one sense, we are the true Church of Scotland. We affirm the constitutional documents of our church, the scriptures of the Old and New Testament, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Articles Declaratory. In any case, I love this church, which has nurtured me and helped me and shown me the way, and it pains me to see it in its present condition. You don't leave the family when the family gets into trouble. I also have a responsibility to those who have called me as their minister to serve them. Well, that's my seven reasons. I could have made it many more, not quite the 10,000 we sang about, but could have managed a few more, but I see Colin looking at the watch. My final section I've called Structures of Unity and Separation. For the reasons I've just outlined, I do not believe that we should leave the Church of Scotland. Nevertheless, we have to give serious consideration to the manner in which we remain for the sake of our integrity. And I want to make just three brief points. First, I for one am not saying that we should stay in the Church of Scotland unconditionally, regardless of whatever decisions the Church might make in the future. I'm simply arguing that on this matter of sexual immorality, it is an insufficient justification for leaving. I've said to my own congregation that if the church bowed to pluralism, denied the uniqueness of Christ as the eternal Son of God, through whom alone salvation is to be found, then I would feel bound to leave. Why? Because at that point, the Church of Scotland would have ceased to be a Christian church. Second, I'm not arguing that we should be content to exist as a party or a strand within a broad church. I've had various people from different sectors of the church write to me in the last few weeks saying it's so important that evangelicals stay in. They're such an important part of the broad spectrum of the church. I'm not arguing that we should stay in as a party within the church. I'm arguing that we should stay in to seek the reformation and renewal of the church and to return it to where it ought to be and where it was at the time of the Reformation. In any case, all this talk about a broad church, the Church of Scotland is not a broad church constitutionally. We are a confessional church. It is a broad church only by default and by a lack of discipline. So I think we stay in not to provide one strand, but for reformation. Third and finally, if the overture does survive its course and is passed in 2015, then in my view, we will have to develop an ecclesiological structure which will affirm our unity as part of the Church of Scotland, but which will also involve a measure of separation, some firewalls. Paul's words have already been quoted from 1 Corinthians 5, but also in 2 Corinthians 6:14 to 7:1, where he talks about separation again. I think that that must be taken seriously. But I do not believe that the separation intended is from the church, but rather from the prevailing party within the church. During the work of the Theological Commission, I argued for a two-synod solution. Gordon Kennedy and I then wrote a detailed paper in favour of that proposal. It was not accepted by the Commission, similar to several other things I proposed. But if the overture passes, I think we ought to give some consideration to this solution. Indeed, it may well be one of the ecclesiological options to which the Theological Forum will give some attention. In the meantime, between now and 2015. We just have to get on with the job that God's called us to. But I hope that today, I share what's just been said by Kenny, I hope that today will signal the beginning of a fellowship of evangelicals who will support and encourage one another and will do everything that we can to be united in spirit and work towards the reformation and recovery of our church, with a proviso that one day we might have to reconstitute as a synod. Thank you.